effort and product put into the pizza. And so we decided that was our route. So it's real buffalo mozzarella, never cheapened or we're not using a cheap version of domestic for it. The oven, the flour, the salt. And then I sent my boys to Keste in New York to work with Roberto, who is the official impresario of Neapolitan pizza in North America. So he's there to maintain the dignity of it. So Robert was sent down there and was certified and painfully went through the exercises with him.
So for the people at home who are going to be cooking from this cookbook, they're not necessarily going to be able to get their hands on that double zero flour. They might not have a good supply of San Marzano tomatoes. What do you say to get them to keep them cooking?
We didn't script the recipes to be too bombastic, and we just kept them very precise, to the point, offered you a lot of variables so that if you didn't have an ingredient, you could rest your mind on something else. So made it a bit more accessible in terms of that. And I think Jake Richler did a really good job of compiling the recipes and making them understandable. So, you know, if you make a lemon ricotta gnocchi, which most people would think is terribly difficult to make, if you read the process, it actually doesn't sound difficult. And in effect, it's not difficult to make. Or a potato gnocchi with a lamb bolognese and minted ricotta will teach you in the book how to make fresh ricotta at home, which is incredibly simple to make. The average person thinks it's really difficult. But if you have a recipe that is too involved and too sort of mechanically based, it even confuses me sometimes when I read chefs' recipes about simple procedures, and I don't get that. So this book is exactly the flip side of that. And my hope is that it sits between your sugar and flour on the counter, and it's soiled, and pages are turned, and it's referred to all the time, because the food is approachable.
And your approach towards using the cookbook is to go shopping first, then look at the cookbook.
Precisely, because that is the Italian kitchen. You shop the seasons, you preserve when necessary so that you have it later, you eat what's in front of you. And that is basically how European kitchens were designed, because they had to be, out of necessity. So I think it's a wonderful formula, and certainly we can build on that here because we have access to lots of things, but as a tradition, I think it's wonderful, and I like the simple nature of the dishes. But they're rich in body and texture and time, and where the recipes appear simple, and they're actually very doable, you need to follow the rules, and you need to follow the bouncing ball to get to the end. It's like even making a proper stock to start your process with, to start your braising of your pork, the stock is a sort of a little ritual that you do.
Yeah, I have.
That's what I like best about it.
I have a cookbook from Parma, mm-hmm. and it's talking about making the meat stuffing for a ravioli.
Right.
And it's like, take this, boil it for 12 hours, let it cool down, and then boil it for another 12 hours. And I'm going, where's the flavor going? But and yet, oh well, you don't actually use that meat. Use the broth that comes out of it to flavor everything that you do. You flavor actually breadcrumbs with it. So it's to look at that kind of cooking. Did it drive you crazy a little bit when it's well, you do it like this, and it's hard to interpret sometimes.
Yeah, some of it can get a bit out there. It's not really achievable for the average person. And when they start reading 12-hour processes, they sort of glaze over and go home, fold it up, and put it back on the shelf. So for me, if the recipes are accessible, when you read the script, they appear to be doable. They give you a certain level of confidence, and then the execution and the recipes, that end of day you get this big flavor whack that hits you right in the mouth, and it's like, wow, that was easy and it was wonderful. Like just braising short ribs and making soft polenta. You know, you do a tomato passata with it. Can be an incredibly special dish. It sounds so ordinary. You do the octopus dish out of here, and you serve the short rib as a follow-up, and you do a panna cotta with seasonal fruit. It can be any fruit you want. You know, sort of follow the guideline. Just a glorious meal. Just bottle of wine on the table, the company, a little bit of bread and olive oil, and it's a perfect dish. It's not rocket science, and it's not recreated or sort of imagined things up, but part of cooking for people is intimidation. And much of what a many, many cookbooks can become very chefy and very, very technical, and sort of a tribute to their expertise. To do the coffee table book, we wanted to do just the opposite, that it's a great reference and it's used.
Yes, I shouldn't say this, but I'm thinking of the Susser Lee cookbook that came out a few years ago, and I looked at that and I said, I'm not making any of this stuff in here.
No, and it's not even really meant for you to make it.
I don't think so.
Right?
Don't think so.
It's more art on a plate. Mm-hmm. And when you look around the room, you can find cookbooks that fall into that vein, and others that are very approachable.
I want to talk to you about your role as judge in Top Chef Canada, but before that, I want to talk about you being judged. And one of the bugaboos, I teach food writing, and mm-hmm. I try to teach people how to do restaurant reviews. And the big debate we always have is, how many times should a reviewer go to a restaurant before the review is written? And do you have an opinion in that area at all?
I think a reviewer should give a restaurant at least 5 or 6 weeks to sort of sort things out. And I think they should have 2 visits to a restaurant before they sort of put pen to paper, so to speak. In terms of critiquing, everybody has a job to do. Running restaurants is very uneven science. And one of the challenges in Canada is that you're not rewarded for being entrepreneurial and ambitious. We're actually, as a culture, we sort of fight against that. So it's a very interesting phenomenon where a U.S. chef can have 20 restaurants and a food writer will never ask them, well, how do you cook in all those restaurants? The first question in Canada that is asked of a Canadian chef is, how will you do that? How can you cook in all those restaurants? So that's the basic uphill climb you have each and every time you extend yourself. And I've had that in Toronto with food writers asking me, why would you want another restaurant and why would you want a grocery store? And I say, well, it takes me a little bit of time to sort it out. If you want to run in the first month and find fault, well, that's fine. Go ahead and do it. I'm still going to do it. And a year from now, I will have fixed anything that's wrong because nothing's easy. And I understand they have a role to play, and it is what it is, right? And as a general rule, they've always been very good to me. You know, on a percentage basis, I have an A score. But you'll take your hits once in a while.
Well, like you say, it is a very complicated business to run. And to have something, I guess if it comes to being a high-end restaurant and somebody goes and they spend $250, $350, $450 sometimes, I guess they figure it should be good the first time.
I agree with that. I agree. When you're charging a huge dollar, absolutely. But I think it should be good no matter what category it is. But things happen, and, you know, there's a real random nature about how a restaurant exists on a daily basis. It comes at you like water comes at the beach, different angle, different intensity, every single day. And sometimes it works for you, and sometimes it doesn't. But it's a fragile, you know, ecosystem you live in. You deal with cooks that have good days, bad days, personalities. It's all about people. It's a very fragile, connected environment.
It's not an assembly line. I mean, at times it can look like an assembly line, but there's so many variables.
Precisely. And by no means am I making excuses in any way, shape, or form, because we go in every single day to try to do a better job. Sounds corny. It's sort of the Boy Scout theory in life. Don't overcomplicate it. Just go in with a positive attitude. And something really nice will come out the backside of it, and it doesn't always work. It's not always perfect, and the role of the critic is to always be perfect, right?
Well, now this is what you're faced as a judge yourself into Top Chef Canada. Really enjoyed the first season, and when you were asked to get involved with that, what went through your head as to, oh boy, I'm going to be, I'm now the guy on the other side of the fence judging what people do, although you do that as a boss all the time.
Yeah, I had a bit of discomfort with it at first, and I asked them, what is it you want from me? What are you expecting from me? Because I don't want to be theatrical for the sake of being theatrical. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to scream and yell at people. I'm not going to throw things. I'm going to call it as I see it, and it has to be a winner and a loser every day. And I feel comfortable calling that. And I'm fair about it. I try to be as fair as possible so that I can track it back and look at it and say, yes, we absolutely made the right decision. And, you know, as you narrow the chefs down and you get to know them and you sort of see the pain and suffering that they go through, you become very connected to them. You can't help but love Connie, and you can't help but respect Rob's cooking, and you can't help but admire Dale's tenacity. So when you're sitting there at the end and you have to pick a winner, it's a hard decision. But on that given day, they made their mind up, and they made the decision for me.
Yeah, so in that sense, that was their only shot. It came down to that, they had to be perfect.
I said, last day, I'm not looking in the rearview mirror. Today is today. Whoever wins today, puts the best show on, wins the day. That's how close it is. And, you know, when you were judging, you wanted to look back in the mirror a little bit. But you had to hold true to it. So I actually, we had a lot of fun. And I thought the show was a great showcase of Canadian chefs. I thought it was a lot of fun in the way the country adopted this show. They just loved it.
Well, I find, because I'm very suspect of reality TV and cooking shows even more so as far as the reality aspect, and I went into this with an open mind, having seen a couple of episodes of, you know, Top Chef in America, and thinking the why I like this is that you've got real chefs on there, unlike some other shows, and they have to do real tasks and really use their brains in it.
Yeah. Well, when we chose them, the producers always like characters. My criteria for picking the final 16 was that they had talent, that they were as good as the group was, that we took the best 16 out of the group. We had 300 to choose from. If they happen to have personality after that, great. If they happen to look good after that, great. If not, and you know, their ethnic mix, if it happened to be a healthy mix, great. If it wasn't, I wasn't just going to pull people, cherry-pick people, because I needed representation in different communities. So it turns out we had reasonable representation across the board, but we had good cooks. We had really good cooks. So end of the day, this year, the cooking, the final six was amazing, like amazing dishes, like even top last year.
And you're not going to tell me who won, are you?
No. No, and if it slips out, I'll have to shoot you.
Yeah, I think so. It did a great job last year in that it did build suspense, and it's good when you don't know who's going to win.
But I was very pleased with the show. I thought the challenges were really tough. Like, to go through it as a chef, I don't care who you are, very difficult.
Yeah, I've watched guys go through the Bocuse d'Or competition. Mm-hmm. Like, oh my God, that's just, you know, so difficult to end up on the top of that. And as a Canadian, you've got a built-in bias against you right from the start. But a show like Top Chef, I mean, we've had the Food Network in Canada now for several years, and I think it's done a lot to kind of raise awareness of cooking. What do you think a show like Top Chef Canada does to that kind of awareness of food in Canada?
I think it's huge. Everybody follows the show, all demographics. Like, it's right across the board, which is really interesting. I have people stopping me all the time. The awareness of kitchens and chefs and what they do, and the food culture that exists in Canada today, from a customer basis, is amazing. And then from a supply side, like, we have all these people coming into the marketplace producing boutique products across the country, which didn't exist before. So it's just percolating up. Like, it's what's happening now. Just stretch it out 10 more years. How exciting will that be as a food scene in the country? I think we're one of the coolest food scenes in the world.
Well, when it comes to stocking your store in Toronto, you must have seen a much more availability of things that you can get from Canada that are unique.
Well, if you take our cheese counter, I have 137 cheeses. 111 of them are boutique Canadian products from across the country, which 10 years ago, probably 75% of them didn't exist. So from farmed caviar to produce to cured meats to you name it, it exists, and it's coming out of our country now. So sourcing is much, much easier.
Well, I guess that goes back to the authentic question I asked you at the beginning, because, you know, we tended to have to invent or reinvent things that we brought with us as an immigrant nation, and now we're being able to stand on our own with stuff. We're building a tradition here in Canada. We've always had that cheese tradition in Quebec, but now across the country there's more stuff happening.
Yeah, I think we've still copied other nationalities. It's not like we've come up with a lot of original stuff.
No, but we have the ability and know-how to copy those now.
Precisely. And the beautiful thing is, in the span of my career, I watched food go full circle. From you had to go to a hotel restaurant to have a good meal when I first started in the early 70s, to now there's just so many good restaurants. It's hard to choose where you're going to go. And the fact that we went through all those different fads of food and we arrived back at fundamental Italian and great basics and the understanding of cured meats, and that all of a sudden the old European science of food is important to us, where it was always there, but we had to go through this whole journey to understand how important it was. So when I look at all my Italian friends, they sort of snicker at us because they knew this 25 years ago when it wasn't cool to make your own salami and have a cantina and tomatoes and put your own peppers up in the fall. And now it's a point of prestige for people to say that they do this. So it's very interesting. For me, it's the whole food scene has really landed in a mature way, where fads are less important and delivery is more important, and a sense of supply chain on the product is an important story. So I think that's where we are today. Those are the questions my clients ask me, and I think thoughtful menus are more important than ridiculously extravagant menus. So that's how I like to cook. That's how I like to project the business in the restaurants and at the store. And I think the future bodes really well. I think Canada's on fire.
Super. Thanks very much.
Pleasure, Don.